The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Rochelle Saunders, guest hosting today for Desiree Shell. This week we're talking about birds. How they think, how their brains work, and what they look like under all those feathers. Later on, we'll be talking with artist Katrina Van Grue about her book, The Unfeathered Bird, where she puts bird anatomy front and center in over 300 stunning drawings. But first, I'm joined by Dr. John Marsliff, professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. In addition to having authored over 120 scientific papers on various aspects of bird behavior and wildlife management, John is currently the leader of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Recovery Team for the endangered Mariana Crow and a fellow of the American Ornithologists Union. Today, we're talking about his recent book, Gifts of the Crow: How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans, which uses a neurobiological perspective to try and understand the amazing feats of crows, ravens, and other corvids. Hello, John, and welcome to the show.
Hello, and thanks very much.
So what about crows interested you so much that you decided to write a book about them?
I guess the thing that interests me the most, really, about these birds is their variable behavior and their strong connection to people. I mean, it seems like whenever I go out and watch them, they do something different and interesting and engaging to me. You know, that's kind of expected for a biologist. But when I talk to people about crows, they always bring up amazing things that they've either heard or seen or experienced in their association with these birds. So that kind of adds an extra dimension to it.
So you actually partnered with an illustrator, Tony Angel?
I would say more than an illustrator. Tony's a fantastic artist. He's a sculptor, as well as an artist with the pen and ink. And he's a very accomplished naturalist. He's got a keen sense for what animals do and how to portray that in stone, bronze, or paper.
So a lot of people writing a similar book probably would have gone for photographs, the obvious choice. Why did you decide to go with an artist?
I've always worked with artists in all the books I've done, and I feel that an artist can give kind of a level perspective throughout the book, the same kind of style throughout the book, which I think is engaging. And more importantly, when it comes to behavior, getting a photograph of the exact behavior at the right time and all of that in the right focus and light, extremely difficult, especially on rare behaviors. So with the skeptical audience out there, I thought it's just better to have these things drawn by an artist reading a description that somebody would have of it rather than trying to get a photograph. Although several of the drawings Tony did were straight from photographs as well.
What's also really interesting about your book, and unfortunately, being the radio, I can't show anyone them, but at the back of the book, there's a whole section that actually has, I guess, illustrations of bird brains and neural pathways, which is really fascinating.
I'm glad you mentioned that. To me, that was a critical part. I'm really not a neuroscientist. I've been studying this and doing some research in it in the last several years, but my training is on the whole bird, not the brain of the bird. But to understand the whole bird, you need to understand the brain. And working with Tony to get those illustrations that, to the best of our ability, represented, you know, the state of the science was, to me, extremely helpful. And I hope to the reader as well. They can read about what we've said and what the birds have done. And then you can look at an image to suggest how that might be working in the brain as well.
So you use a mix, or I guess work with a mix of researcher anecdotes, civilian anecdotes, and also experimental stories of experiments that people have done throughout the book. Why did you feel it was important to include as much anecdotal material as you did?
It's a way to go about science, in my mind, is anecdotes are the raw observations that a scientist uses to generate hypotheses and questions and further inquiry about. Without those observations and the attempt to validate them and corroborate them, which we've tried to do, you really are left with a pretty small amount of information. To be able to look at the possibility, all the potential behaviors that these animals do really requires this kind of army of citizens out there making observations and reporting them in a way that is not challenged immediately, but instead considered and brought into a larger frame of information to really determine, is this valid? Is this something that's worth us considering and probing more deeply?
It was really interesting in the book as well, because in a couple of places with a civilian anecdote, you actually bring in your thought process insofar as actually analyzing, did this actually happen? How seriously can I take this anecdote? And you sort of brought us through that process, which was really cool.
The thing that was most striking to me was when I first got this email from a guy who actually lives only maybe 5 or 10 miles from my house. He's crazy about crows. He feeds crows every day, puts out chickens and pizza and everything else he can get, puts it out for these birds. And he told me that one day he went out and he said to the birds, I give you food every day and you never give me anything. Why don't you give me something? And that afternoon on his feeding tray where he puts the food was this candy conversation heart with the word love on it, a Valentine heart. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that a scientist gets and is skeptical about, to say the least. And actually, you hope the guy who sent you that email never figures out where you lived and never gets in touch with you again. But I stuck with it on this case. And Gary invited me over. I went and saw the material that he had gotten from his feeding tray. It included the heart and a little butterfly, a metal butterfly, and sticks and cones and rocks and all kinds of weird things. And I thought, phew. Maybe there's something to that. So we posed hypotheses, again, trying to use that initial observation as a generator of ideas that we would then confront with other data. And we did. We started confronting it with other things people had told us, and they got similar sorts of gifts, pieces of glass or plastic Cap'n Crunch figurine and all sorts of things. So while none of those people spoke to the crows and none of the crows responded in writing as they did to Gary, they did give gifts, and it was pretty compelling evidence that those gifts were left there by birds that had visited a feeder or had somehow come back to a person who had done them right. What seemed initially implausible all of a sudden was possible and likely from the standpoint of gifting a person in return for some behavior like providing food or shelter or rescuing an individual bird. And so I thought, well, that's cool. We're kind of left with two hypotheses. Either the birds purposefully made this association, were trying to reinforce the feeding, or they were just carrying around these weird things like keys and figurines and rockets and beads and left them by chance when they found something better like food to eat. And so I was kind of left with those two ideas, and I was pretty much sold on it's probably you know, just kind of a mistake. They have these things for whatever reason. But then a nice new experimental study was just published in PLOS One, one of the top journals in our field. And it came out about a month ago from colleagues in Austria. And what they had done is they trained ravens and crows to exchange items for food. So the experimenter holds out holds the two hands out to the cage where the bird is, and the bird has to reach out, grab a rock, bring it back into the cage, and then deliver the rock back to the person. And when he does that exchange of the rock, he gets a piece of food, either a grape or a piece of cheese. And the birds, they did that right away. They learned that exchange of an action for food with a human right away, just like we had hypothesized perhaps Gary's birds had learned to exchange with him. What's more interesting is how sensitive they are to what they're doing and what they're exchanging. And in the case of this controlled experiment, what the researchers found was that the ravens and crows would work very hard, exchange very accurately and persistently if they got cheese relative to grapes. And cheese, I mean, crows and ravens, they like cheese. They'll work for cheese.
The better the gift, the better the food, I guess.
Exactly. Well, they were willing to provide a gift for good food, kind of like Gary was getting for the ultimate food.
Right.
And then what was really cool is they set it up so that there were two birds actually working with the person, two different people. And if the bird that was the focal study animal was working and looked over and saw the bird next to them getting rewarded with cheese, let's say, for doing the same thing that he was getting rewarded for with grapes, he quit working. And likewise, maybe a female in this case looks over and sees that the bird next to her is not having to work at all for its cheese or grapes, just gets free rewards, that bird also would quit working, quit exchanging the rock for whatever food it had. So they're very sensitive to the quality and the fairness of the exchange, and added a lot more credence to what we had initially thought was ridiculous that it could actually be a strategy some animals are using in the wild to get people to work with them.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders, and we're chatting with Dr. John Marsliff about his latest book, Gift of the Crow. So before we get in too deep, I want to make clear that we're actually not just talking about crows here. We're actually talking about a larger family of birds, right?
Yeah, we're talking about the corvids, or the family Corvidae. It is about 140 species in this family of birds. They're one of the songbirds, or passerines. And in this family, we've got the crows and ravens, but also the rooks and jackdaws and magpies and nutcrackers and jays. Lots of birds around the world. All continents except Antarctica have them.
A lot of the book deals with the intelligence and sometimes the uncanny human-like intelligence that a lot of these birds possess. Is there a physical reason why this corvid family is so smart?
There's kind of a physical as well as some aspects of their behavior that lead to them being smart. First off, they do have large brains for their body size, exceptionally large. They're much more on the line with small monkeys than they are with a bird of that given size with respect to their brains. They're outliers in that respect. And within the brain, the forebrain is the largest part of the crow's brain, and it's exceptionally large, again, relative to other large-brained birds. It really is, again, built much more on the monkey line, a large brain and a large forebrain especially, that's able to bring in information from many different sensory organs and integrate that and assess it and use that information to command its behavior. They have that going for them. They also have two other aspects. One, they're social for the most part. These animals live with certainly another mate that they have a permanent pair bond with and they coordinate their activities with. And they also often live in social groups that might include family members or extended flocks. The advantage of living in a social group like us is that they can learn from the actions of others, not just their own trials and tribulations. So they are big-brained, social, and they're also long-lived. So they can gather experiences, their own experiences, and those of others throughout a long lifespan, maybe 10 to 40 years, not unusual for these birds, gather a lot of experience during that time.
So in your book, you talk about how corvids can consider and then reconsider. What are you talking about when you say that?
What's going on here is that there are actually physical connections among neural pathways that go from the forebrain down to the thalamus and back up to the forebrain. And if you think about it this way, you're bringing in information, or a bird is bringing in information through its eyes or ears or sense organs like its bill for a bird or your hands and fingers. That information comes into various parts of your forebrain, stimulates neural circuits there. And the typical response after it's assessed is to send neural messages back down through the midbrain and brainstem and spinal cord to your muscles to do things. That's behavior. Birds do that, certainly, and it's very reflexive, a lot of that sort of behavior, commanded by even signals from your forebrain. But what you can do is bypass that route. You don't have to send what you're thinking about straight down your brainstem and spinal cord to your muscles. Instead, you can loop it back through your thalamus to your forebrain and re-stimulate those neural circuits that had the idea and process that information in the first place. And you can adjust it. You can consider it and shape it, modulate it with past memories and current emotions, and shape how you're going to send that command eventually to your muscles to behave in a certain way. Birds can do the same thing. They can literally think and reconsider things before they have to act. That's how they learn songs a lot. They'll process that information they're hearing, say by their father or their neighbor, and start putting together a repertoire of a given song. They can adjust it in their forebrain by re-stimulating and making new connections between neurons before they have to actually send it down to the throat muscles to sing. And this is how you can learn and shape and adjust things without actually having to act them out. And birds do that, and of course mammals do that, and the neuroscientists that are studying this sort of the physical aspects of this looping behavior have shown that reptiles also have some of this loop, but not as extensive as birds and mammals. And amphibians, to our knowledge, don't have this ability yet.
Crows and ravens always seem to have an almost unlimited ability to learn new things. But it turns out some of this learning and forgetting is actually kind of seasonal, right?
Because the brain of a bird, as well as a mammal, including us, can grow new neurons throughout the year or throughout the lifespan of the animal, they can change the connections that occur, and these connections can ebb and flow with time. So with birds and corvids, you see this especially with the nutcrackers and some of the other jays that are very specialized on harvesting seasonally abundant foods, like pine seeds that mast all in the fall. And the birds go into the pine forest where the seeds are, the same seeds that you put in your pesto, for example. And they harvest these pine seeds and they store them throughout the fall, tens of thousands of seeds throughout the fall. And as they're doing that, they also have an enlarged hippocampus, which is the spatial memory center of the brain. And that affords them many more neural connections with activity at a certain place and the activity of caching and locating perhaps some of the local cues and spatial coordinates of this place where they're storing their food. So these memories or these associations between a place and the presence of the food and digging in the ground and the local place where they put the seeds are stored as neural pathways, basically, in their hippocampus. And that hippocampus is large in the fall. And then in the spring, when the seeds are all harvested, the hippocampus shrinks in size. Other parts of the brain may increase, like those associated with social behavior or singing. But the hippocampal volume decreases during the time of the year when they no longer need to remember and have already harvested those seeds. And that may be a way that some of those connections are forgotten or cleared out of the brain, literally. And then it grows again in the fall when it's needed again.
I didn't actually realize this. So you're saying the brain actually, sections of the brain actually grow or shrink in physical size?
They do because of neurogenesis. They're growing new nerve cells that are migrating to that part of the brain and increasing it or not, depending upon the season.
So one of the things that I know differentiates humans from a lot of other animals on the planet is that we can think about the past and prepare for the future. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's some evidence that crows can do this as well.
There is some evidence of time travel or mental consideration in corvids. And some of the best examples come from very controlled laboratory studies in Oxford, in particular, Nikki Clayton's lab there that's worked with scrub jays, a small corvid from the arid portions of the U.S. And they store all kinds of things, not seeds for the whole winter like a nutcracker, but bits of lizard and worms and beetles and some pine seeds. And some things last longer than others, and they seem to keep track of that. And they go and they store things and then recover them in the order with which they would likely perish. So that's one example of them kind of keeping track of viability of food through time and going to places where the food's likely to still remain viable given when they stored it. The other thing that's cool with that is they did some neat experiments where they could anticipate the future, and that is the future availability of particular kinds of food. And in some rooms in their cage, the birds would always get, let's say, mealworms, and in other places they would always get pine seeds, but not necessarily both, only one or the other. Well, the birds that were used to getting fed mealworms in the morning wouldn't cache mealworms back in that part of the cage because they were anticipating getting them. Instead, they would cache the other food item that they wouldn't typically get. So they'd have a mixture of foods. And they were adjusting their behavior at a certain time to what their expectation of food in the future was.
It's also been shown that crows and other corvids can build and use tools, right?
Yes, some corvids do. Not all of them. But the New Caledonia crow in particular is the gee whiz of all animals when it comes to building and manufacturing and using and passing on to its relatives given types of tools. This is an animal that lives in the islands of New Caledonia, as strange as that may seem, given its name. And those islands do not have woodpeckers. So there's a whole niche available that under that area, under the bark or in the soil where a woodpecker would typically probe its bill and use its long tongue to get food, insects and the like. Those animals aren't on the islands where the New Caledonia crow lives. It's basically taken that niche over and extended its bill and tongue through the use of manufacturing hooks and probes and things like that from bits of leaf material and stems of trees and branches. And it uses these, again, to access foods that are abundant, but in most places where crows and ravens occur are taken by other birds. So this bird is fantastic at making tools and using them, But all the other corvids occasionally do, but it's not a regular part of their behavior.
So what kind of tools are we talking about here?
Well, they take and they'll actually make step tools, they're called, and hooks and skewers. And they do this from the leaf of a pandanus tree in particular. It's like a palm frond. When you rip a palm frond crosswise, it goes, breaks, you know, as you rip across it, and then you would peel it back and you might have a long, almost something that looks like if you broke a little and peeled and broke a little more and peeled and broke down more and peeled, it would look like the blade of a jigsaw. So they use this jigsaw-like chunk of palm frond as kind of a skewer to stick in under things and then hook on any of the teeth of that saw bit to bring grubs and other sorts of insects out from underneath the bark. They also make plain hooks where they'll take the stem of a leaf and break it off and take the foliage off, and then you've got the crooked part at the end of it that's like a crochet hook, and they'll use those again to hook things. And in the lab, they've taken bits of wire and fashioned hooks from wire to solve a very complex problem, and that is getting a little bucket of food out of a clear tube. And it's a great video. You should check out the Oxford website and find the video of Betty, the New Caledonia crow, and you'll see her take a piece of wire and initially try to use it, just use the friction of it to pull up a small bucket of food. But that doesn't work, so she sticks it in the duct tape that's holding the tube upright and walks it around and crafts a hook out of it by that lever action. And then she takes that hook in her bill and rams it down the tube and wham, gets the handle of the bucket, hauls it up, and gets her food treat. So she really uses insight into fashioning the correct tool for a particular task. And that's really what sets these birds apart.
Are they teaching themselves this just by sort of figuring out the problem? Or is this more of like a social learning where they've seen someone else do something similar?
It's both, I think. They certainly learn from their own experience, but they do pass down within a family group the culture of particular kinds of tools. They differ on different parts of the island. Some tools are used more frequently than others. So there's some cultural component to this. But young birds that were raised in the lab were very interested in using tools, picked them up, and started using them appropriately as well. So there's some genetic component now to tool use, the propensity to try things maybe and to start probing with these and learning from your own experience. And then there's also a social component where a particular type of tool in a particular location takes on a heightened status.
I had heard of crows using tools before, but what really surprised me was the fact that they've been seen to actually wield weapons at each other for defense or to chase out other birds who are in their territory.
The best word to describe the crows and their kin are innovative. They try everything, and they often take great risks to drive off predators from their territory, and that has obvious payback. Get a predator out, your nest is more likely to succeed, or you're more likely to live. Not only do they use their own body to drive that predator out, but ravens have been observed wielding sticks or crashing branches down upon an owl to try to get them to move. And then my major advisor observed at his bird feeder a situation between a jay and a crow, both corvids, trying to access the seeds at his feeder. And the crow was eating away, and the jay came up, and instead of just rushing at the much bigger crow, it flew down to a nearby bush and ripped off a branch that it used like a lance and came galloping, so to speak, at the crow on the feeder to try to drive it off with that lance. But again, not a good thing to do against a very smart animal, because all the crow did was reached around, grabbed the stick from the jay, and chased the jay off with it himself. So they're very inventive and they try things. I think they're always experimenting and learning from their trials.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders, and we'll be right back to continue our conversation about the corvid bird family in just a minute.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, guest hosting today for Desiree Schell. We're here with Dr. John Marsliff, professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington, talking about his latest book, Gift of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. Okay, so aside from making tools of their own, crows and ravens also seem to have the ability to learn really complex activities. For example, you spoke about how they learned very quickly to pull at meat tied to pieces of dangling string.
They understand connections between things, and Bernd Heinrich at the University of Vermont demonstrated many years ago that ravens could learn if they pulled up a string with food on it, they would get the food. Rather than just flying at the food and being stimulated by the presence of food, they understood the connection between the string and the food and worked a very complicated set of maneuvers where they would pull the string with their bill and have to step on it to hold it in place and reach down further in the string and pull it up and step and pull and step and pull and step. Byrne demonstrated that the ravens would do that right away and crows typically would not. And he also demonstrated that they had a harder time understanding if strings were crossed, but they could eventually figure that out as well. So those studies were quite influential in getting people to think that, wow, these birds really are able to kind of see the end product that they're going for, have insight into a particular problem. More recent studies have shown that a big component of that ability to do that sort of thing stems from the immediate reward the bird gets with each pull. And as the food gets closer and closer, it's rewarding and kind of self-rewards and motivates the bird to do that. There are probably signals in the brain and dopamine and endorphin releases in the brain that are motivating and rewarding them for each of those steps. And that could keep them going. So they might not have to really understand everything up front. They can just understand, I'm getting better, it's getting closer, it's coming along, I'm getting there, and they stick with it and get the reward eventually.
And there have been even more complex problems presented to these birds, including a three-step task that they had to achieve in order to get the food where they couldn't necessarily sort of see a string going up or something like that.
There are two different experiments. It'll take a little bit to explain them. So the first one kind of shows the importance of seeing the food coming to you. And what you can imagine here is looking through a small hole, as you can barely see the food and the string, and as you're pulling it up, you really don't see the reinforcement of that food getting there. And the birds wouldn't do that. This was with New Caledonia crows again. They wouldn't stick with that task, suggesting that that immediate reward was important. They gave them a mirror. By looking in the mirror, they could see the food. They stuck with it. They did the task. They don't necessarily understand every step along the way, but if they're getting feedback along the way, they stay with it and do well. But in another task, the three-tool task that they did with New Caledonia crows, it really suggests, again, insight here. And this was a pretty amazing experiment, I think, just in the ingenuity of the researchers from New Zealand setting it up and the birds accomplishing it. And what you have here, imagine three pieces to a experimental apparatus. One is a small stick hanging on a string, kind of like the meat or cheese on a string. And the bird has to pull that string up to get the small stick and then use that small stick as a tool to go over to another cage which has a gridded front that they can use the small stick to reach in and access a longer stick. Then they have to take the longer stick out of that puzzle box and fly over to a tube and use the long stick to sweep out a piece of meat from there. Getting the small stick by itself gives you nothing. I mean, there's no food on the end of the string. It's a stick. And having the small stick doesn't get you the food because you have to use it to get the big stick to get the food. Well, the birds had been exposed to different pieces of this, but never the whole series of all three things in one room. So birds had goofed around with trying to use a big stick to get the food or trying to access a stick out of a gridded cage. They had also fooled around with pulling up the string for the small stick, but it never did them any good. So they never got any reward for getting a hold of that small stick. And then after that bit of experience, they were put into a situation where they saw in one part of the cage a small stick hanging, in another part a cage with a big stick behind bars that couldn't be accessed directly, and in yet another part a food that was out of reach in a tube. And the average time to solve this problem is 6 or 7 seconds. And what the birds do is they fly immediately to the string and pull it up and grab the small stick and use that to fly over and get the big stick out of the jail-like cage and then use that big stick to get the food. I mean, they're not sitting there trying to do anything out of order. They've clearly looked at the situation, assessed it, and made the decision that to solve this problem, I need to get the big stick. To get the big stick, I need the small stick. And they go right to it and just hammer it out.
That is pretty cool. I think there's probably some humans that might not be able to wrap their head around that task. One of the topics you cover quite a bit in your book is the sort of entanglement between humans and crows and other corvids, and in some cases, how we may have even co-evolved or how they're potentially manipulating us to get the things that they want.
I see this as two social organisms that are interacting, and social organisms can evolve through their genetic composition as well as their cultural traits. And our culture and the evolution of our culture has influenced these crows and ravens for millennia, millions of years. And their culture and social behaviors have influenced ours as well. So some examples, to me, kind of the best example of this back and forth coevolution is with some of the jungle crows in Japan. And we'll start off first with the human culture. And the humans have brought in trees, which they found pleasing. These, in this case, were English walnuts, not native to the area. They planted them, they grew, and nuts developed. So the culture of us wanting to bring things in from other places and modify our environment led to this new food resource for the crows. And they started to utilize these nuts, but they couldn't crack them with their bill. So they innovated. And some animals started placing the nuts on the road or dropping them, and eventually cars running over them, and eventually to the point where they would actually use crosswalks and traffic signals to wait for stopped cars in appropriate places, where they would then fly down with a nut, place it in front of the car, get out of the way, and when the car traffic resumed and the car ran over the nut and cracked it and then stopped again, the bird would go back down and get the cracked nut. So they started using our driving culture to secure a new food source that we had brought in. This went through several steps, presumably. We see this same kind of behavior in other parts of the world, but not to the extent that the Japanese crows do. It's more dropping or just opportunistically feeding on nuts that have been run over. Here, it's very purposeful. And that behavior spread through what looked to be social learning, because it kind of gradually spread from a center of innovation. So the social behavior or culture or tradition of the crow was influenced by our culture of driving and planting new things. And that's continued. And in fact, the interest in this behavior has stimulated Japanese drivers to be very dedicated in particular in how they drive to make sure they run over the nuts now for the birds to be able to continue this behavior. Kind of tit for tat response of humans and crows that really intrigues us.
I want to talk a little bit about these birds and the fact that they're sort of well known for their ability to learn human speech, which is really fascinating. And your book delves in a little bit into what this means. Are they actually learning the words, or are they just mimicking something?
The whole idea of language in animals is really controversial, and it's fraught with a lot of misinterpretation and speculation. But what we see in parrots, for example, of course, and also in crows and ravens, and a lot of people don't know this, but if you've raised one as a young bird, which a lot of people did in the 40s and 50s and 60s when it was legal, people would raise baby crows and ravens, and they would quickly start to mimic human speech and say words very, very accurately, sounding very much like the person who was saying these around them. Sometimes the birds would do this right back and forth to the people, and sometimes they wouldn't. They'd stay silent, and I've got stories from people who had a crow that would never talk to them, but then was recorded talking to other people in other places. It was an interesting crow that ran away from one owner during the day and would go to school, went to a neighborhood primary school. And actually, the principal thought it deserved to be in third grade by its activities, placed it in third grade, and the bird would talk in class. And the people never even knew their crow was doing this during the day, because in evening, it'd be back home with these folks. Was reported in the newspapers around, and just thrilled the kids to have this crow come in and talk with the language of a third grader. There are some examples like that, and you might think, well, does the bird know what it's doing? Or is it just mimicking mindlessly these noises that it's learned? Because crows and ravens are songbirds, and one of those neural loops that we talked about that allows them to consider and shape before they act is the song learning loop, forebrain loop. And that allows them to hear things and kind of record and adjust and perfect and then utter those vocalizations very precisely. So anyway, these talking crows, you wonder, do they know what they're saying or not? A lot of birds, you think, well, they're just mimicking and parroting back what they've learned. But some of the things we've heard about these crows and ravens suggest they know what they're doing. So a couple of cases in particular, there have been at least two cases where young children were called back to their home by their mother. And they were running back home. Mom, what do you want? Because mom's been calling, hey, Johnny, let's go. And they come home and mom's not there. It's the crow. And the crow has imitated the mother's voice perfectly, intonations, everything, to get the kid to come back home. So they seem to use this voice in appropriate settings to get some action out of people, not like they're just mimicking back in a mindless way. And another example of this involves Kevin Smith from Missoula, Montana, who was awakened early one morning by his dog barking. He went out to the kennel to look and say, you know, Vampire, what's going on? Why are you making all this noise? And Vampire wouldn't shut up, and neither would the guy who kept calling, here, boy, let's go. Here, boy, come on, let's go. And the guy goes out to the kennel and says, what the heck's going on? And up from behind the kennel pops a crow saying, here, boy, come on, boy, let's go. He's trying to call his dog away. And Kevin was astounded that this bird, one, would even do this and could do it for that matter. And as it turns out, this bird evidently flew around Missoula for the next couple of weeks where the university is and rounded up dogs, calling them and bringing them from their yards onto the university campus, where he'd hold them at bay under a tree, yelling at them, here, boy, come on, let's go, let's go. And the dogs, of course, very obedient. Yeah, where do we go? And finally, the students would get out from class and the crow would take off and run the dogs through all the students. And our suggestion is maybe, you know, in doing that, it knocked loose a sandwich or a bag of chips or something. Or maybe it was just doing it because it was fun and it got a good endorphin release in its brain and had that as a reward, basically, for this crazy behavior. So that's one for you skeptics to really think about, I think. I mean, this is, to me, here's a bird who's out, got a skill, a human language, using it to its own devices, basically, maybe as a food gathering strategy or maybe just because he likes doing it, but out on his own, using his own words.
One of the things that also surprised me was that these birds can be intentionally deceptive. And also they understand to some extent that other species don't see the world the same way they do. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Both of these ideas kind of imply a theory of mind that the animals know what another animal's thinking or can think. And again, extremely difficult, controversial to prove. There's some evidence in its favor and a lot of evidence against it as well. But some evidence in the favor of this is the caching behavior of corvids and caching excess food and remembering where they put it. But what's interesting is if they caching in a situation where there's others that can watch them, they tend to fake out the cache. They don't put it in the ground where they seem to be digging, but they'll hold it in their mouth and go someplace else and cache it there, try to avoid another bird seeing it make its cache. And what's also interesting is that in an experiment, if they're allowed to cache in the presence of another bird, and then they are allowed to recover at a later time, when that bird is present, they'll go right to the cache and get it, because presumably they know that that bird knows the food's there. But if they're in a cage where they previously cached, and there's another bird there that didn't see them cache, wasn't there at that time, they won't go get the food. They know that bird doesn't know that the food's there, and so they'll just keep it a secret. So that kind of deception with food storage has been shown in a variety of corvids now, and it's pretty convincing that indeed they're sensitive to the knowledge that others have of where their food is.
Alternate to the case of deception, they can also cooperate and strategize together for mutual gain.
One of the key aspects of these birds is the long-term pair bond. It's a monogamous, permanent pair bond, lasts for life. That pair of individuals comes to be very coordinated in their activities. They really know and read off of one another very well and act as a coordinated unit rather than two individuals. They'll team up to steal food from wolves and from dogs. They'll distract a dog or an eagle in the front while the partner goes around the back and grabs the food as the dog or eagle's lunging at the other bird. They will team up, like we talked about, to scare an owl out of their territory or to defend their space against other conspecifics. They're very attuned to the actions of their social partners and use that to their advantage.
John, as much as I would like to continue, we are all out of time. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
If you want to learn more about John Marsluf, his book, Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans, or his research, you can visit skepticallyspeaking.com, where a link to his website will be available in the show notes.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're taking a closer look at the code that runs our computers and permeates so much of our lives. Guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to software professional Mark Bennett about his passion for programming and coding as a career or as a hobby. We're joined by Sergey Maslov, a researcher in computational biology at the Brookhaven National Laboratory, to learn about the similarities between computer code and genetic information. And Stephen Gold, vice president of Watson Solutions at IBM Software Group, gives us the scoop on new healthcare applications for cognitive computing technology. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell. I'm talking to Katrina Van Grau, a former curator of the ornithological collections at London's Natural History Museum, who is also a taxidermist, experienced bird bander, successful fine artist, and a graduate of the Royal College of Art. She's the author of Birds, a historical retrospective of bird art, published under her maiden name, Katrina Cook. She's here today to talk about her new book, The Unfeathered Bird. Great to have you with us, Katrina.
Thank you.
So this is a book about the anatomy of birds, but it also isn't. How would you describe it?
I didn't want people to think that it was going to be the sort of textbook laboratory sort of manual. It's a very, very different book that is about bird anatomy, but also it's an art, believe it or not. It's a sort of coffee table book about the insides of birds. I'd originally actually planned it to be a book for bird artists. So it's very, very visual, lots of pictures. No guts and gizzards, musculature and skeletons and tongues and feet. And the parts of the birds influence the outside, the external appearance. So it really isn't a technical thing about different tendons and nerves and so on. It's about bird anatomy, but it's really not an anatomy of birds.
Well, you mentioned it being a coffee table book, and I will tell you, since I received it, that is exactly where it has been. So mission accomplished.
Great.
So why did you decide to do such an untraditional anatomy book?
My training is actually as a fine artist, and 25 years ago, as an undergraduate, I was doing a lot of pictures of whole birds, living birds. I was very inspired by Audubon, and I wanted to do some background studies, take some birds to pieces, find out what was going on under the feathered surface. As a search for my pictures of whole birds, which gets back to the actual aim for the book, to be a book for artists primarily. And I began with a dead duck that I found on the beach, in fact, and took her home and took the skin off, drew the muscles, took some more muscles off, drew some more, and eventually stripped down the whole bird and produced loads and loads of drawings and thought then, hey, this would be a great idea for a book for other artists to use. And they've taken 25 years for that dream to become a reality.
I have to say the drawings are gorgeous, absolutely beautiful. But it doesn't picture every bird, so how did you decide which ones to include?
Oh, that was so difficult. If I hadn't had a deadline, I could have just gone on and on and on forever. The last few months were just spent with me saying, oh, gosh, I've really, really got to include the foot of the turaco or the windpipe of a manicode and so on. I just wanted to go on adding birds forever. But there are 200 different species of nearly every major bird order. So I've managed to get at least a lot of the different things in.
From what I understand, there is a tremendous amount of debate over bird taxonomy. Can you explain that to lay people? What is that argument about?
Taxonomists are always striving to arrange animals in the order in which they evolved originally, which for birds is actually very, very difficult. And just when we thought we were beginning to get somewhere, then molecular studies, DNA studies came in, and it was like throwing the cards up in the air, and everything sort of fell in a different place. Threw up some very unexpected relationships, and we're still not sure how closely certain things are related, and there are some very surprising sort of ideas out there, and different taxonomists have their own interpretation. So I wanted to avoid all that like the plague and stay firmly on the fence and not allow that to... I didn't want people to say to me, hey, which taxonomy are you using? And, oh, are you sure about that? But what about the second so-and-so nerve of the, you know, surely that's evidence that, you know, I wanted to produce something much more accessible and usable and fun and useful for artists and ordinary people, and didn't want to get tied up in any of that sort of taxonomic debate. So I did something really quite unorthodox. I went right the way back to Linnaeus, the very first person to introduce scientific names, a binomial, the name of Cho, we call it, the name, the generic name for the group and the specific name for the species. And he arranged his bird very much according to the outward appearance. So long-legged wading birds altogether, game birds and birds that live on the ground altogether, perching birds altogether. So I went right the way back, square one if you like, and deliberately used taxonomy that's not accurate, that doesn't reflect real relationships. But the great thing about this was that I could then compare birds that were similar. So then show that even though storks, cranes and herons all look the same on the outside, they're actually subtly different on the inside, which was perfect for my needs.
But in the book, you do discuss the actual relationships between the birds as well.
Oh, yes. As far as we know, and I'll say taxonomists think that so-and-so is related to such-and-such, but there are these other schools of thought. So I've tried as far as I can to bring it absolutely up to date in the actual text, even though it seems a bit strange for anybody opening the book for the first time. If they are up on their bird taxonomy, they might think, oh, this is a bit old-fashioned. if they actually read the text, though, they'll find out that I've mentioned the up-to-date true relationships as well.
So although there is a lot of variation between the birds, there are some generic features that all birds share. Can you tell us about those?
All birds originally descended from single flying ancestor, and so they all fundamentally evolved for flight, even though certain groups have actually lost the power of flight. For example, penguins have adapted their wings and structures to, because they're actually flying underwater. They're wing-propelled diving birds, but they can't actually fly, of course. And ratites as well, the ostriches, emus, cassowaries, their ancestor could fly, but they've now lost that and put all their structural energy into walking on the ground and attaining very large size.
Wings are literally the only generic feature of a bird?
Feathers. All birds have got feathers, and the only birds have got feathers now. There were some dinosaurs in the past which were feathered. In fact, paleontologists are discovering more and more about the extent of feathering on dinosaurs in recent years. I mean, there's been so much learned about that. In terms of birds, they're very different from other groups. Unlike mammals, they've got two sets of ribs. So they've got a set of ribs which join onto the breastbone, as well as the ones which come down from the spine. They've got a large flattened breastbone with a big keel, like a keel on a boat, which sticks out underneath for those enormous flight muscles to be attached to. They've got a wishbone, same as we have, but most of the time it's fused in the middle to make a continuous round, lovely curved shape. They've got very, very manoeuvrable necks, but a very rigid body. So the body's very much adapted for supporting the frame during flight. So during those very strong contractions of the flight muscles, you've got to have a very rigid body to actually protect the internal organs and not just collapse under this pressure. So also on the ribs, they've got little unsonic processes which point backwards and overlie the rib behind to just give extra support to the rib cage. Similarly, they've got a pelvis which is just lots and lots of fused bones together. And the tail's got a lot of fusion on the final vertebrae to give them the bone we call the pigostyle. So long neck, short tail, and lots of fusion within the actual body.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about the unfeathered bird with author and artist Katrina Van Grauw. Well, let's talk about the structures that the book uses to group birds. The accipitres section?
That was Linnaeus's term for the birds of prey, which he included owls in as well.
So what features do those birds share that others don't?
Well, anybody can, of course, think of hook beak, big talons, which is pretty fundamental. Talons for grabbing, the beaks for tearing. They've got quite strong legs for holding their prey. So they've got a compact, usually quite curved pelvis, which supports all those muscles for grabbing their prey. Ridges over the top of the eye sockets for protecting the eyes when they're following prey through perhaps undergrowth or any sort of foliage vegetation, and maybe even against the sort of kicks or flaps or bites of the prey animal. So quite overshadowed eyes, which gives them that wonderfully fierce expression. But within the accipitres, within the birds of prey, they form into separate groups. So you've got your eagles, which rely on grabbing their prey with these great big sausage-like talons, enormous great talons. And it's all about force. It's all about holding the thing and keeping it there. Whereas sparrowhawks, which will, I guess your equivalent is sharp-shinned hawks, isn't it? Those lovely long-legged birds with... The skeleton's quite long-legged, but I guess when they've got the feathers on, that doesn't actually show. But for those birds, it's all about reach. So compared with other birds of prey, they've got incredibly long legs. If you were to take the feathers off a sharp-shinned hawk, you'd see just how long they are. There's not a sharp-shinned hawk in the book, but there is a sparrowhawk, which is, say, European equivalent. And when you're chasing a small bird through vegetation, through the woods, the bird's going to be changing direction all the time, disappearing into a hedge. And these wonderful, wonderful birds of prey have got fantastic manoeuvrability, got short rounded wings, gives them the ability to change direction fast, and a long tail as well, which acts as a rudder and stabilizes them in the air and gives them these quick changes of direction. But it's all about reach with these birds. And when they do actually come into contact, just before that small songbird disappears around the corner again, they thrust out their legs. You can don't get an idea of just how long they are. And even the middle toe can just grab the bird just with the tip of the talon and fold it in and get it in its grasp before it gets away. In fact, another bird of prey which has got fantastically long legs is harrier hawks, which live in Africa. And they eat weaver birds, eggs and nestlings. And weavers have got a pendulous sort of shaped nest which hangs from trees. Just a small hole that goes into the nest, and chicks and eggs will be down the bottom, of course. So these harrier hawks can thrust their leg into the hole, but of course they have to then feel around with it. And if they're often described as being double jointed, it's not a double joint, it's a normal joint, but the tendons allow greater flexibility, so they can actually twist their leg backwards and sideways and in all sorts of angles to feel around the inside of this great big pendulous nest to find what they want.
Now, you've also included owls in this section of the book, and you say that owls are the perfect example of Linnaeus's convergent evolution. How so?
They're not related to other birds of prey at all. In fact, they're quite a long way apart in what we know now. But they also have evolved hook, beak and talons, and lots of people think of owls as birds of prey, but ones that just happen to come out at night. But in fact, just because they hunt live prey, that's why they've got talons and a hook beak. It's not because they're related to birds of prey, and that's the reason. So these are birds which are actually probably more closely related to nightjars. They were almost certainly nocturnal first and became birds of prey afterwards.
Now, how about Gallinae? Tell us about the birds in that section, because I find those fascinating.
All the walking birds and wading birds, yep. They're, in fact, what we would now include is galliforms. We would now think of chicken-like birds, pheasants, all sorts of game birds. But Linnaeus also included any walking birds. So he included bustards, ostriches, and other ratites. I mean, nowadays we know that the ratites are very, very primitive, not close at all to the pheasants and so on. But Linnaeus put them all together because they're sort of walking land birds.
Now, are all the ratites flightless?
The word ratite means raft-like, and that actually refers to the shape of the breastbone. If you imagine the keel, as we said, to be a keel on a boat, and if you imagine a raft, it's got no keel. So that's where the word ratite came from, is raft-like. And, of course, without a keel, you can really not have any flight muscles. So as the name sort of implies, when you know the origin of it, there are no muscles there to actually support flight on a true ratite, which is why they are actually flightless. But the story gets much more interesting when you consider the other really ancient birds which came before the ratites, the tinamous. Now, tinamous just look like partridges or grouse. They're very dull looking. They're small, inconspicuous, brown, unassuming, walk around on the ground a lot, and they're actually very, very hard to spot. Anybody would normally think they were just game birds, but they've got this dark secret. They're old. They're very, very old. They're older than the flightless ratites. Tinamous are probably closest to the first birds as we know them, certainly the oldest birds alive today. They've got certain anatomical features that connects them with the ratites. They've got a certain shaped pelvis which doesn't have the amount of surface area of bone that other birds have. They have got a keel on their breastbone, but it's quite shallow and doesn't really support sustained flights. So these things can barely fly. They can do a nice quick takeoff, but then need to land again very quickly. They have not got terribly strong legs because of this primitive shaped pelvis, but they're absolute masters of camouflage. They can just hide, and they'll use the actual forms of the terrain, the rocks and stones and boulders and shadows. They actually use the shadows to hide behind, and they're terrifically good at this. And when you consider that they're not great flyers, not great walkers, and pretty tasty, and then consider that they live on continental South America with all the predators there, and there hasn't been a tinamou extinction in historic times, and there are lots and lots of species. They're terrifically successful birds. And yet they owe all of that, despite their underprivileged background, they owe all of that just to stealth tactics.
Now, many of the birds that you've drawn in your book, you actually had to get your hands on the skeletons, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And I just want to be clear as to what that means, and you referred to it earlier, but that means putting them boiling on your stove, correct?
Yes, it does. Well, I mean, there are different ways of doing it, but that's the way we did it.
Okay, now my question is, now, according to your website, you are writing another book, this time on animals. So what do you plan to have boiling on your stove now?
Yes, this one's about domesticated animals. Now, we included some domestic birds in the unfeathered bird, and most ornithologists do rather look down their nose on domesticated animals and think, oh, you know, just a pigeon, just a chicken. But in fact, if it hadn't been for domesticated animals, Darwin would never have come upon the theory of natural selection. And they're actually fantastically interesting things to study evolution in miniature. Man making all these selective decisions, selecting for usefulness, meat, wool, aesthetics. It's actually a highly interesting subject. So to get back to your original question, yes, we are now producing. I am now producing pictures of dogs, cats, pigeons, chickens, even horses and cattle. And of course, we can't prepare horses and cattle at home. But last week, we did have a greyhound that we were skinning in the back garden.
You have an interesting household.
Absolutely. It was funny, a neighbour came out and sat on his wall outside, and he was just a couple of feet from where we were skinning this dog. And I think, don't look round.
Katrina,
the
wonderful.
The greyhound, by the way, was given to us by the Royal Veterinary College. It was an X-rating greyhound, and it was there for dissection by the students. And they've actually lent it to us to prepare for their museum.
Katrina, wonderful to have you here, and I very much look forward to your next book.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You can find Katrina Van Grau and her new book, The Unfeathered Bird, at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And one more thing before we leave you. I wanted to give a shout out to Susan Gerbeck and her team of Gorilla Wikipedia editors. Their mission is to improve the skeptical content of Wikipedia. They do things like providing noteworthy citations, removing the unsourced claims from paranormal and pseudoscientific pages, and improving the pages of skeptic spokespeople. If you'd like to see a sample, please do head to my Wikipedia page, which is now beautiful and correct. And they do all of this because evidence is cool, and the people of the internet deserve it. You can check them out at Gorilla Skepticism on wikipedia.blogspot.ca. And they are always looking for volunteer editors, plus they're willing to train you. So if you already spend a lot of time on ye old intertubes, maybe this is your thing. Thanks to everyone at Gorilla Skepticism, and please keep up the good work. We've included their link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you can get all the show news and chat with members of the Skeptically Speaking team. And of course, you could also keep clicking to iTunes, where you can download past episodes, subscribe to the program, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.